From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. Over the next several days, NPR is airing a series of World War II stories. Our stories coincide with filmmaker Ken Burns' new documentary series, The War, which begins Sunday night on PBS. Today, we bring you the story of an extraordinary group of men. The 10th Mountain Division was in combat for only 4 months, but it had one of the highest casualty rates of the Second World War. The division started out as an experiment to train skiers and climbers to fight in the mountains. After their deployment, the men of the 10th went on to lead a series of daring assaults against the German army in the mountains of Italy. Producer Joe Richman of Radio Diaries brings us this audio history.
Well, right now, we're on top at about 11,000 feet at the Santa Fe ski area. I'm Bob Parker, formerly of the 10th Mountain Division. I'm now 84, and this is the 70th year that I've skied. I'll probably continue until I drop dead on the ski slope. I think now I'm ready to go. I've got my poles ready. My oxygen is working. So let's go skiing. All right, here we go.
My name is Robert J. Nordhaus. I'm 95 years old. I served in the 10th Mountain Division from the time it was organized in 1942.
My name is Nuke Elbridge. I was in L Company.
My name is Al Weybrick. I was in Company K, 15th Infantry.
My name is Dick Wilson, and I served with M Company, the 85th Regiment of the 10th Mountain Division.
My name is Dan Kennerly. I was born in Georgia September 21st, 1922. I was one of the few people in the 10th that never learned to ski.
The 10th really got started in 1940, I believe it was. The U.S. Army decided they were going to form a mountain unit.
And the reason was, our infantry just weren't ready in terms of equipment or clothing or anything for winter warfare. If we had to go into Norway or Finland or if we had to fight in the Alps, we'd have to know something about how to fight in the mountains.
I heard about the 10th Mountain Division being formed. At that time, it was called just the ski troops. And I knew that I was going to be drafted sometime, and I didn't want to go into some outfit that didn't appeal to me. And, of course, being a skier, it was a very glamorous idea.
I went and talked to our personnel man. Paratroops was filled up, so just out of the clear blue sky, I just said, "How about the ski troops?" He said, "Where are you from, soldier?" And I said, "Georgia." He said, "Y'all ski in Georgia?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Where?" Well, the furthest north I'd ever been was Gatlinburg, Tennessee. And I told him Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Of course, it's a big southern ski area now. He says, "What do you wax your skis with?" I never had seen a ski. I said, "Beeswax." He kind of grinned and looked over at his assistant there, and he says, "You know, I think this fella can make it." 7 days later, and I was on my way to Camp Hale, Colorado.
It starts with a bugle blowing reveille over your bed when you arrive. Hey, Jack, that's the G.I. Jive.
Camp Hale, it was in the Pando Valley. It's just across the Continental Divide on the west side. And we got there, and I got off the train, and I saw this big white snowbank 7 feet high. And I thought to myself, what have I got my tail into?
Me being a boy from the flatland of Monroe County, New York, to get up there and see that type of mountain, I just didn't know they existed. Just amazing.
So when we got to Camp Hale, they issued us wool ski pants, two kinds of parkas, wool socks, gloves with trigger fingers, and after a while you learned how to use them.
Oh, I was excited by the equipment, the lovely white skis and the finest bindings I'd ever seen. I couldn't wait.
F Company reporting for ski instruction, sir.
Very good, Sergeant. At ease. You men are here to learn military skiing. Some of you have skied as civilians and followed certain standard techniques. You will find that the Army has added to the best of these techniques to create better ones of its own. That's all. Good luck and good skiing.
Left. Pace!
It was a little more hazardous because you had a 40 to 50 pound pack and coming down with a big pack, and then you had these bindings that didn't come off, bear trap bindings. You had to know how to fall or you'd break a leg.
And here they come, shooting down the long white slope like a string of comets. Watch them do that first fast turn, still keeping formation as they change direction. Yes, those long weeks of training are showing amazing results.
It was very rugged training. We lived in the mountains for weeks, working at altitudes of up to 13,500 feet.
It was out in 5-6 feet of snow, and at night temperature would get down around 20 degrees below zero. But you had to learn to do the right things, because you couldn't put a boy out in that below zero weather all the time unless he knew what he's doing. He'd be dead.
We had a lot of older guys with us who knew the score, knew what to do. We had old mountain men, and if you listened to them, did what they told you to do, well, you didn't get frostbite. The old-timers said, rub bacon grease all over your face, ears, noses, fingers. It'll really help with frostbite, and it did. And if your feet are really cold at night, you wake up your partner, and he has to sit up, and you put your cold feet against his warm tummy. And after a while, you switch, and he puts his cold feet against your warm tummy. It does wonders for feet that are starting to get too cold.
We'd actually dig snow caves, and then with candles, just candles alone, it would ice up the inside of the cave, and pretty soon it was warm as you could be, just because the heat from your body and so forth, and the candles. But you could strip right down to your shirt and shorts and be very comfortable in a snow cave.
And then I learned something very quickly, is you never drink any liquid after, say, 4 o'clock. Because the worst thing in the world is getting out of a nice, warm sleeping bag, 20 degrees below zero, to have your call of nature.
It was cold all the time. It was snowy all the time, and, you know, hunger. But it also was overall satisfying because we knew after we did it a while, we were getting in better and better shape. We were getting stronger and stronger.
Now, you got to remember, the war was really moving along.
After we finished our training, they really didn't know what to do with us. I think all of us would have hated to think that we put all that training in this and then end up missing the war entirely.
Our division was probably originally designed to fight in Norway. But the Germans got there first. Then the next real mountain fighting that was going to take place was in the Apennines, in Italy.
It was Christmas Day or something like that. They boarded us onto the ship and said, okay, you guys are headed for Italy. We were finally in a combat zone. We hoped, in many ways, just to prove ourselves, which I think eventually we did.
In the closing months of 1944, forward units of the American Fifth Army were faced with the task of breaking through these ridges of the German Gothic defense line.
After the fall of Rome, the German army retreated to the northern Apennine Mountains. There was the Gothic line, and then there was the winter line. And that's where the Germans made their stand.
Mount Belvedere was the highest mountain there, and U.S. troops had been stymied there for about 6 months.
You have to realize that the Germans had literally years to prepare, number one, their defenses. And, I mean, they had fantastic defense systems set up in these mountains. And they did this because this was really the last bastion. As long as they control those strategic points, nobody was going to get on through Italy.
Men who haven't been trained in the mountains look at a mountain and they think it's too much of an obstacle for them. And our guys just said, we know we can do it. So our commanding officer, General Hayes, he planned a nighttime assault on Riva Ridge on the 18th of February, 1945.
Here was the situation at the front as General Hayes saw it from his command post.
On my left is Riva Ridge, and it was essential to capture Riva Ridge to prevent them from looking down on our flank and rear.
Riva Ridge was a vertical granite on the south face of it. So you can stand on top and you can see miles and miles and miles out there. You can see everything that moves.
At that time, the mountain was covered with snow, ice, very steep, very, very difficult conditions. And so at night, the Germans went to bed. They didn't even keep guard patrols going up there, because they didn't believe that any American unit could climb that ridge night or day and drive them off of the ridgetop. Well, they were wrong.
Expert rock climbers began climbing the ridge's jagged rocks and, without making a sound, fixed ropes for the use of units that were moving up from below.
Even pounded pitons in, and they had their piton hammers wrapped in cloth so that the Germans wouldn't hear them pounding in the pitons at night.
These men were climbing with heavy packs, full ammunition.
They got to the top of the rock wall. It was just about daylight. And they got into a pretty vicious firefight up there. The Germans counterattacked, but they held them off. And they captured that rock wall.
At dawn, a single platoon of Company A reported that it had occupied the northern end of the ridge. The 10th Mountain Division, still considered green, had chopped the key threat out of the Gothic line.
It was an incredible operation. So it was the next night that we attacked Belvedere. That was a different cup of tea. There weren't that many casualties on Riva Ridge, but on Belvedere, there were a lot of casualties.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. During World War II, 13,000 soldiers of the 10th Mountain Division were sent to Italy to fight the Germans. Close to 1,000 would die. From producer Joe Richman of Radio Diaries, our audio history of the 10th continues with the fight to take Mount Belvedere in Italy's Apennine Mountains.
Well, I've always thought that anything as important as a war, that you ought to keep a record of it, of what you did. I decided that I was going to keep a diary of it. I tried to be as accurate as I could. Monday, February the 19th, 1945. We assemble for the attack. The moon is just rising above Mount Belvedere. No one talks. I guess everyone is alone with his own thoughts. The order to move out is whispered around, and we begin to file up towards the line of departure. Our success depends on the element of surprise. Sergeant Postman repeats, "All weapons will be unloaded. No weapons will be fired until after daylight, when the order is given." That was a smart move, because they didn't know where we were.
Keep in mind, it was laced with barbed wire, mines. The Germans were dug in. It was terrifying and difficult, but you kept on going because the guys next to you kept on going.
I think I remember more than anything else was when the Germans started the phosphorus flares. Even though it was night, the whole countryside was just bathed in it's a very eerie light, kind of frightening.
The ground is becoming steeper and more difficult to climb. The first rays of the sun bathe the snow with a yellow glow. It's momentarily quiet. after several minutes, an American machine gun opens fire. Its sound is beautiful. Everyone rises and starts running toward the saddle. All hell breaks loose. Men are yelling and screaming. Shells seem to be falling everywhere. A German machine gun fire opens up. The bullets kick up dirt around us and make a loud popping noise as they split the air nearby. The two men I'm following go down. They yell for a medic. I pause to help, but remember the general's words to keep moving.
We were fairly close to the summit when I got wounded. I was hit by, I think it was mortar fire, but I'm not sure, German mortar fire. And right away I knew I'd been hit. In fact, I could see the two bones in my wrist sticking up in the flares.
You know, a bullet that's being shot at you, if it comes close to you, it makes a popping noise. And they'd have artillery firing on us, and they'd be hitting close by. And I start shivering. I just shake like this. And I guess it's fear, because I sure hell had a lot of it.
On the morning of the 20th, one whole battalion reached the top of Mount Belvedere. But the trick, as they soon discovered, was not just to reach it, but to hold it.
As I cross a small stream, we begin to receive mortar fire. German shells land further down the valley. The valley looks peaceful. A farmer is plowing his field with an ox. How strange. Two powerful armies are locked in deadly combat, yet the farmer goes about his daily chores, paying no attention to the drama around him. That's the strangest thing I ever saw.
As the 87th swung to the northeast to firm up the Belvedere line, evidence of the cost of that action began to show.
The sound of battle begins to die down. We have taken the saddle, but there's not much left of C Company. I hear they have lost their captain and over half of their men in the assault. Their bodies are scattered along the slope. They are lying everywhere, frozen in many different positions. Some have their arms or legs sticking straight up. Nothing is supporting them. Others remain in a firing position. There's a strong scent. At first I cannot place it. Now it comes to me. It is the odor of a slaughterhouse. What I'm smelling is blood.
Belvedere was a bloody battle for the 10th Mountain Division, particularly, of course, the 85th, which really took the steep side.
I think there were about 300 or 400 killed in Belvedere alone.
6 p.m. The light is fading fast. I think of the friends I lost today. This morning, they were alive. Tonight, they are rotting in mattress covers. I stare up the endless sky and mutter, "Thank you, Lord," and fade into sleep.
Belvedere was a tough mountain to get.
It was a stalemate until we made that breakthrough. Once we made the breakthrough, the German army collapsed, and our division just kept going all the way to the Alps.
Headlines bring the people of the United Nations the most sensational news of the war, the surrender of Italy. In New York, Americans of Italian descent are first to celebrate. Vino for victory.
I saw a peaceful old valley.
When the war was over, an awful lot of guys went to Colorado, went to Wyoming, Montana, and found once they were there that there was a possibility of making a living in the mountains.
I mean, they were ski instructors, they were ski school directors, they were college coaches, they were Olympic coaches. Ski resorts started by 10th Men, Winter Park, Arapahoe Basin, Vail. Just name any aspect of the ski business after World War II and you'd find one or more 10th Men involved in it.
Jerry Cunningham invented the down coat. Bill Bowerman invented the running shoe.
Hundreds of them literally went back in to the ski world. Rightfully so, they can claim that they were the foundation on which the post-war ski world took place in the United States.
fight for this country before I was born.
Well, that's the whole story. Oh, yeah, I miss skiing. I get up to the top of the mountain and watch. No, but I'm sure I miss skiing, but you got to quit sometime. I skied till I was 90.
As long as my artificial knees work and my artificial eyes work great, why not ski? Oh, that feels great.
Pound of rock, stack a pound of rubber too. He'll shoot the mountains like his daddy used to do. Early in the morning.
The voices of former 10th Mountain Division soldiers Dan Kennerly, Bob Parker, Nuke Eldridge, Al Waverick, along with Dick Wilson and Robert Nordhaus, who both died this past year. Our story was produced by Joe Richman of Radio Diaries. You can find some photos of the 10th Mountain Division at npr.org, along with a preview of upcoming stories in NPR's series on World War II. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.